This week's episode of Still Entitled is made possible with support from Linksys. Bad Wi-Fi is usually due to your Wi-Fi equipment rather than your internet provider. Update to Linksys and kiss dead zones goodbye. Linksys solves the biggest Wi-Fi issues like buffering and connection problems, and you can easily set up guest access and parental controls. Visit Linksys.com to save 15% on a new router with the code UNTITLED while supplies last. Cannot be combined with other promos. Refurbished products not eligible for this promotion, one per customer. Once again, that's Linksys.com with the offer code UNTITLED to save 15% on a new router. And now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Well, hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Wait, he was gone?
We had continuity last week?
We had continuity, well, somewhat.
Stealth vacation.
I don't like to tell people when I'm leaving town.
Yeah.
Because I don't want, you know, some gang of Paris Hilton jewelry thieves to come rob my house or something.
I can totally see that. They'll get all your Yeezys.
But my lovely, brilliant, amazing wife wrapped up her master's degree in marriage and family therapy.
Congratulations.
A couple of weeks ago, took the certification test, passed it. She's now a licensed marriage and family therapist.
Well, I have some business for her.
As we had planned for, actually, I think the better part of a year, we hightailed it out of town, I think 4 days, 5 days after she passed the test. I had wrapped up a bunch of projects as well. So we just spent 2 weeks in Spain and Italy on a wonderful, super relaxing, amazing vacation. Did I say amazing twice?
Well, yeah, that's fine. You're allowed to say amazing twice. You went to amazing places.
We spent, we flew into Barcelona.
Nailed
so,
it.
You know, of course, we get to Barcelona, and the first thing we wanted to do after we'd spent a day wandering around, we watched Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Of course, it's the perfect thing to do. It's in the name of the movie.
It is almost unwatchable.
That's a Woody Allen.
It's Woody Allen. It's Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, Scarlett Johansson. And a bunch of wonderful bit players. Everyone in it's just fine. It's really funny to see, like, Scarlett Johansson, I think she's become a much better actress over the years, and I love her performances. It's very funny to see this movie where, Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz are so amazing.
And they have the chemistry.
And they have so much chemistry that actually Scarlett Johansson ends up a little bit like overshadowed by them, which is kind of impressive to see.
I don't know that I've ever actually seen that movie.
Oh, it's worth seeing.
Okay.
It's worth seeing. Like I said, the characters are great. We stayed right in the middle of the Gothic Quarter.
Ooh.
I'm going to start posting some of the photos on Instagram because you can't take a bad picture. Barcelona is an amazing city. It is. I felt super at home. The saturation of English speakers is wonderful, but also everyone's really great about you trying Spanish and they're really supportive and they'll talk slower. I love that city.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
So if you're in like these two major places, right? It was Italy and Spain.
Well, this is the thing is we spent 4 days in Barcelona, 2 days in Granada. Then we drove from Granada to Seville, which is about a 2.5-hour drive. We stopped at a wonderful little city called Antequera, which has like a 5,000-year-old burial ground on the outskirts of town. And then we spent 10 days in Spain and then 3 days in Rome.
What is your vacation strategy when you're like blocking, like how is 4 days, is it a very impacted 4 days? Is it peaks and valleys?
This is a really good question. We structured this vacation incredibly well.
This was heavily planned.
Heavily planned.
Because lots of times when you go on vacation, it's kind of like, let's get where we're going and see how it goes.
Well, what we did was we had a friend who travels a lot and she uses a travel agent. And the travel agent makes arrangements for you based on the things that you're interested in. So we gave her... we said, look, we're going to get into Barcelona. We're going to not do anything for 2 days while we try and recover from jet lag. On the third day, we'd love a guide to take us around the city. We would want to visit the Casa Mille, the famous apartment building, mm-hmm. the Sagrada Familia, I mean, which is completely jaw-dropping, as everyone says. And seeing the Gaudi architecture up close, it's unparalleled. And we had a wonderful guide for 2 days, for the last 2 days in Barcelona. I think all across the EU, you get a special certification as a tour guide that actually allows you to cut past all these lines and have front access to tickets. And it greased the wheels so that we were seeing things rather than waiting to see things.
Wow, that's awesome.
And it made it much like... So the travel agent we worked with charged us a really reasonable fee as a couple to just make all these arrangements for us.
That's lovely.
She's been doing this for a long time. So we said, here's the kind of hotels we like. Here's the amount of money we'd like to spend across the trip on hotels. Here's the amount we'd like to spend on food. Here's the places we'd like to see. So in Seville, for instance, we spent an entire day with a bird watching guide on a national park on the west coast of Spain, bird watching.
That's amazing.
Which was fantastic. We spent an entire day with that same guide walking through the old quarter of Seville, visiting monasteries and ceramic artists and little shops that were bookbinders and like all sorts of wonderful little treasures.
That's lovely.
The food was in general really great. We got caught out at a couple of Fisherman's Wharf type steakhouses by accident here and there.
Avoid the Planet Hollywood, I hear.
Yeah.
But you didn't leave feeling with travel FOMO, right?
Not at all. And in fact, in Rome, we stayed at this wonderful Degli Artisti Hotel in sort of northern Rome, right at the Spanish Steps. Mm-hmm. So the best thing that we paid for, and it wasn't cheap, but it was really significant, was early access to the Sistine Chapel.
This is something you can pay for overnight.
We hired a guide who, like, a car picks us up at the hotel, takes us to the line, and we were like the first three people to walk into the Sistine Chapel that morning. Literally, you walk in, you look around, and then 5,000 people show up.
But like that 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. No, it's real. It's totally incredible. And the guides have all of this wonderful history. We spent in Granada. God. We went to the, what was it? The big castle over there. The Alhambra in Granada is incredible because it's literally been there since the 12th century. And you get to see like all of these buildings that got built up. It was a Roman fort, right? I mean, like the amount of history going on in Spain was super thrilling. And the guides are all amazing at telling you the stories about what this room. We stood in a room in which Queen Isabella of Spain received Christopher Columbus in chains because he'd been arrested for his poor treatment of the colonies.
Wow.
We stood in that room. Like, that was incredible.
What? When the Sistine Chapel was empty, what did it sound like? Does it have a weird room tone? Like sometimes old buildings,
especially. It didn't have any reflectivity in the room tone.
Okay.
The thing that is the most surprising about the Sistine Chapel is the illusion of depth is so much more convincing than you think it's possible to be.
In the art.
So on the big wall that Michelangelo painted in his 60s, on the back wall, there's a figure over top that literally looks like it's carved and sitting out from the wall. And as you look up and you see the nine panels of the three different God creating the earth, Adam and Eve, and then Noah and the flood, three panels for each. As you stand at each crossover, if you're directly underneath it, the perspective works for you right there and only there.
Wow.
And the other stuff looks slightly farther away. But then as you get underneath each one, the perspective has this effect of kind of making all the colors pop because the shadows are all in the right place.
Wow.
So the optical illusion works as you move through the Sistine Chapel. It augments your experience of the panels.
How the hell did he do that while he was laying on his back 40 feet off the ground on a scaffold?
And he was like 33 years old.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's incredible.
It's totally incredible.
It's one of those things that you can't experience unless you're there, because in a textbook or on the computer screen, you lose all of that.
And listen, we got to see a whole bunch of tours that people do where you go with a tour group. There's like 20 of you and the tour guide has like a flag.
Yes.
And they're talking into a microphone and you're all wearing little radio packs.
Yeah.
This is really cool because it means that the guides aren't yelling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very quiet way to go through these spaces. And we went to the the Basilica, and this room holds like 16,000 people. And it wasn't crazy over noisy.
Oh, that's lovely.
It was really, really nice.
Really murmuring of information.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember I when I worked on Capitol Hill, one of my jobs was to give tours to people who came by the office. And like you would, when you crushed into another tour, it would just be a massive yelling and hoping you got all of the people that were in your group back with you when you went to the next stop. And like the radios, it's a good change.
Yeah, it's a really nice change.
Thanks, technology.
I can't gush enough. I had never been to Spain. I can't gush enough about how much I loved Spain and the people of Spain. I want to go back. We're already talking about going back next year. We just had the loveliest time, and the food in Barcelona specifically was fantastic. Mm. I mean, in all over Barcelona, when you go into various places, whether they sell pastries or groceries, they're constantly selling these little bullet sandwiches with the copa and the other kinds of like the sliced meat. And they're like $1.50 for one of these sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
We just made sure we had a fresh one every night, because when jet lag woke us up at 2 a.m, we wanted to chew on something.
Yeah, what's better than salted meat?
Fantastic. Yeah. Yes.
Wonderful bread.
That sounds lovely.
We bought all sorts of wonderful meat.
Do you leave a trip like that? I mean, do you return from a trip like that with physical objects or just the photos and the memories and the stories?
We bought a couple of things. We went to, in Seville, we went to the, where was it? No, my apologies. In Barcelona, we went to the Picasso Museum, where I actually bought a little Picasso terracotta bird, which we brought home.
Mm. Oh, cool.
We also, the men in Spain and Rome dress fantastically.
Did you come back with suits?
I didn't come back with suits, but I came back with a lot of really beautifully cut shirts.
Which hat did you take?
I took the big cowboy hat.
Okay.
Which was a mistake.
America.
Yeah. It's at one point, Julia spotted a group of drunk Spaniards see my hat, and she was like, take your hat off right now. I always travel with the red NASA baseball cap as well. So I wore that for a while. And then in Sevilla, I went to, the fancy hat store where like you go for your church hats. And I bought a beautiful, I don't have it here, but I bought a beautiful, very, very classic Spanish, the brim flat as a razor.
Oh, wow.
Gorgeous hat. It's my new favorite hat.
Like a Spanish Inquisition hat.
No.
Okay.
So Spain really moved me, how much I loved it. And Barcelona is an incredibly walkable city. We probably walked 5 miles a day every single day.
Oh, wow.
I mean, we walked everywhere. And Google Maps makes that so freaking easy, especially being able to see where you're pointed.
Yeah.
Again, I hadn't traveled on such a wandering kind of like, let's explore the city, let's go to this and then walk all the way home, the 3 miles home. And Google Maps made that all relatively trivial.
I envy all the college students who go on their, you know, overseas summer trips now with the smartphones. I never had that.
Yeah.
And it must be completely different.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't mentioned it on the podcast, but my son, who just started college this fall, was in Europe over the summer, and he was leaving Berlin on his way to actually visit Laura Kampf.
Mm, yes.
And He'd left the hostel. He was on the train to go to the train station to take the train out of Berlin. And he's looking at his phone. And just as the doors go bing, bong, someone grabs his phone and bolts out the door. And he's sitting there with all of his luggage. And there's nothing he can do.
Yeah, you're boned.
Yep.
You can't even find the Apple store to go buy a new phone.
No.
Wow.
So he That's called terrifying. Us. It was, yeah, in the middle of the night, he called us and we were like, okay, well, maybe you can get it. And which basically it ended up, he only had 3 days left on the trip anyway. So yeah. He ended up changing his ticket and flying home a couple days early.
Oh, that stinks though.
Yeah. No, it was brutal. It's like part of that is welcome to the world.
Yeah.
This, as a parent, you'll find as your kids get older that it's kind of delightful when they get stressed out because that's the world. The world is stressful.
Well, it's part of our job.
You got to be able to deal with
it. Yeah.
So for some reason, teenagers getting really stressed out is something I find deeply pleasurable.
Well,
so
it's because you're still scared of them a little bit, right? It's funny. My daughter is in first grade now. And like the thing we've realized is that they have either feelings that are all the way or none at all. So like there's no in between on disappointment or scared upset.
Yeah, totally.
It's either 100% or like, no, everything's cool, Dad. Yeah. What's wrong? Learning.
So that cope. Was the trip.
That's awesome, Adam.
Photos will be posted. You got to have lots of photos on Instagram.
We'll be posting. I'll be posting photos over the next couple of weeks on Instagram and Twitter of some. It's all tall, thin, wonderful Mediterranean streets.
Sounds great.
1,200-year-old avenues and
wide enough for a donkey.
Oh my God! It's amazing how well cars move in these ridiculously thin, tiny streets. Because one thing Americans don't have is good car proprioception.
No
one knows how wide their car is. If there's a bicyclist, they just stop.
Yeah.
And in Europe, the roads are half as wide and everyone's driving.
No thanks.
Yeah, it was amazing.
I think we should just change the cities to not fit cars at all. That's my plan.
So I've driven in Scotland. I've driven in England. I've driven actually in Australia and New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
I found Spain to be the easiest country I've ever driven in. You find some places you go, you understand the rhythm. And in Spain, the rhythm was really easy to grok. And the way Spanish people drive was really like, it was something I just gelled with. I would never want to drive in Rome ever.
No.
Rome was terrifying. That whole sequence from Night on Earth where Roberto Benigni is plowing through the streets of Rome in the middle of the night, that's what driving in Rome is like all the time. And the cab driver is singing. It was crazy. Oh, okay. Sorry, before we move on from this, as we're flying from Spain, we spent like a week and a half in Spain. We love Spain. Now we get on a plane with Vueling Airlines to go from Spain to Rome. And we're on this plane with a crap ton of Italians.
Yeah.
And the Italians are all like, they dress crazy wonderful, like sundresses with combat boots. And like everyone looks great. Everyone's beautiful. It was awesome. And we're on this plane and we're just about to take off. And then the pilot comes out and he says in Italian and then in English, we're having a problem with Marseille airspace and we're going to be delayed for 90 minutes. And the second they hear that, the entire plane full of Italians stands up and starts talking to each other really fast, like a movie about your central casting of what Italian people would be like. And nobody's stressed out. They're just all like, bada, 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 bada. They're just
lots
all
of
talking
hands.
To each other.
Oh, that's
it was like instant cocktail party. Wow. It was so much fun. Jewel, we're just watching this like gobsmacked by such a different cultural reaction to a flight delay. They weren't happy about it, but they were like, oh, okay, as long as
the best of it.
Yeah, let's all talk.
Wow.
So that was Spain.
That sounds absolutely lovely,
Adam.
It
was fantastic. Right. On the flight back, I watched a whole crap ton of movies that I don't even remember, but I did watch.
Always a mark of a good film.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Here's my question. Is there anyone who's not in that movie? Like every bit player was a fantastic actor.
Those movies have a ton of people in them.
I had no idea how deep and wide the cast was.
So, did you watch Skull Island?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
No, same thing. Smell. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Just
yeah.
packed
yeah.
with wonderful actors.
I mean, it was a globe-trotting movie, right? You had Vera Farmiga and
Vera Farmiga
and Eleven from Stranger Things, the daughter.
Yep.
But yeah, this main central family, and then they travel the world because the monsters are coming from all around the world.
Yeah.
Godzilla did, included.
I will say, it's so hard to make a thing. The movie, I think, was flawed in its plot, specifically because there's literally no resting time in that movie. It starts at 90, goes to 100, and stays at 100 for like two solid hours.
Which I feel like is a response to, because it's a sequel to the Gareth Edwards Godzilla. That was
which took like an hour
ago.
And a half exactly. to get to Godzilla.
Very slow, it was very slow. Build right. to Godzilla fighting the same monster essentially three times.
And I really felt like I liked how quickly you got to see Godzilla. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, great. This Look, is the movie yep. that we're in. We're seeing monsters right away.
I don't show up to a Godzilla movie for intense character studies and self-reflection
no,
on the meaning of
I
life in a world
either,
filled with monsters.
But look, remember that Joss Whedon fought so hard for the farmhouse scene in the Avengers.
Mm-hmm. In the second one. In yeah.
the, it, because you needed the breath to go to Clint's farm from in the middle of all this crazy action. And the studio kept trying to cut that scene, and it turned out to be a really important breath. I felt that the Godzilla film, and I don't know if this is on the cutting room floor, needed a few breaths like that, because every frame of that movie is beautiful. The monster battles and the citywide stuff was incredible.
With the score,
the choirs. I mean, it's yeah. just surpassingly beautiful. Gorgeous. There just was no space to rest.
And you watched it on one of the smallest screens possible.
actually, you know, there was a pretty big screen.
Oh, okay. Oh. I wasn't on the airplane.
What's that?
I wasn't on the airplane.
Where that, I was sitting.
Different
was,
sizes was in bigger. Different parts of the plane, Norm.
I understand now.
I thought that, I like, look, I don't expect a perfectly constructed movie when I go see a Godzilla movie. I expect to see a busted weird movie with a lot of giant monsters fighting each other and then some humans getting stomped and maybe winning, but yeah, maybe not, who knows.
No, it was very enjoyable.
Yeah.
I tried to watch the Lego Movie Part 2, which turned out I'd already watched it and I loved the crap out of it again.
It's funny, that movie I liked more on multiple watchings. I think we talked about it after I saw it the first time in the theaters with my daughter, and it didn't land with me at all.
Oh.
And then of course it came out on video at home and I've watched it 60 times since then.
Yeah.
And each time it gets a little bit better.
You guys aren't Succession heads, are you?
No,
everybody in the world has told me I should watch Succession. No, and I would really love it, but it's
an acquired taste. I found it a little too upsetting to watch. I watched the first season slowly because I find the emotional damage of all the characters to be a little bit grueling, but holy hell, the second season finish is delightful.
Okay.
And everyone in it is just killing at their roles.
I feel like I should learn to trust HBO at this point. Like, it feels like everything they put out is excellent.
Like, they landed even the Leftovers.
Yeah, that stuck its landing. Yeah. And then,
speaking of Leftovers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Holding in Love.
This is, and when we finish this podcast, I'm going home to watch Watchmen.
I've watched Watchmen, I think, two times, maybe two and a half
really?
At this point. Yeah.
Really?
First episode came out this past weekend, or by the time you're listening to this, the second episode will be out already.
Right.
But I wasn't super enthused about before it came out. Like, do we need this?
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think we needed that.
Yeah, right. And then after watching the first episode, I feel like we do need it.
So the thing... And
Damon Lindelof is the executive producer.
He's a showrunner. Yeah. Regina King, who was also in The Leftovers. And Damon Lindelof loved working with her so much on The Leftovers. He, I think, has like a rule not to work with the same actors again between projects when he can, because he's a showrunner now. But he chose to work with her specifically on this.
Is the sheriff Don Johnson?
It is. The sheriff is Don Johnson.
Yeah, man, so, he's having kind of a renaissance right now.
And deservedly so. Yeah. He's a wonderful actor. Regina King, I met her at Comic-Con last year. It was one of my favorite sightings. She was talking to Aisha Tyler, who's a good friend. And so I felt okay about sort of interspersing myself just to tell her how much I love her. I've loved her ever since Jerry Maguire. She played Jerry Maguire. She played Cuba Gooding Jr.'s wife.
Yeah.
I majored in marketing, Jerry. I came to play. She's so amazing. So I can't wait to see her in this.
So this her performance in this first episode was enough that I was like, man, I should go back and watch The Leftovers, because I never finished that.
Oh, yeah, worth watching.
The thing that I didn't expect. So this watching this first episode made me wonder if this is what the Watchmen graphic novel made people feel like in 1984 or whatever.
That's what they're
came
going
out.
For. They're 100% awesome. Going for that.
Like, awesome.
It is not plot wise. It is not connected to the graphic novel as much as some people would like. It's not a retelling of that.
It's not like it origin is, stories or any bunk like that. No, it's just,
it is a whole new story in that world, which is an alternate reality, of course, where, you know, Nixon was president for 30 years. And if you read the graphic novel, you will understand that world more, where it comes from. But you can watch it fresh, and it's its own take, has its own, like, has own thing to say.
Well, and it opens, like, the cold open is the Black Wall Street riots in Tulsa in the 1910s.
I love that is getting some real play, because people don't know.
That's some shit that they don't teach people in the school in the South, even.
It is by design.
This is a story about white people getting so mad about an affluent Black community that they flew planes over and dropped firebombs and just destroyed an entire fucking
killed
town.
Hundreds of people.
Oh my God.
Destroyed a bunch of businesses.
Yeah.
Ran people out of, it's super. And it's such a conscious choice to start with that.
The Tulsa riots, and it's not a riot.
Yeah. No. Well, some people are rioting, but it's not the riot implies something that is not the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
I found it utterly transfixing. It's shot in a way that feels more cinematic than television, which is not uncommon now.
I mean, the only thing really you need to know about what the show is trying to do in the feel of Watchmen is that it's telling a piece of history, true history, that a lot of people don't know about. And the frame in which they're telling this, because it is not about superheroes initially.
Well, it's about authoritarianism and vigilantes and fascism.
But you see the lens of that event through a mother and father saving their son and sending their son off to be saved, which is the Superman story. And that is quintessential Watchmen.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I also just remembered I watched the new Hellboy on the plane.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet. I
haven't seen that.
Yes or no? Oh, you're shaking your head for the audio listeners. sorry.
Look,
sorry,
again,
Hellboy.
It is hard to make a thing. It is hard to make that movie with the budget they were given.
Yeah.
Because they clearly weren't given enough. I love David Harbour. I love Ian McShane. The casting is in general terrific. It just, the totality of it doesn't feel like it holds together as much as I wanted it to. And I could see how much they were leaning into the Mignola comic book, where Guillermo was doing something wholly different. I mean, obviously taking from Mignola, but he had such a specific vision that was adjacent to Mignola's vision, that if you love the comic books, the first two Hellboy movies, they're a little bit different than you expect.
A little more fantasy.
And this one's moving way more into fantasy. The comic book style of the filmmaking. But still, they took time to do all this origin story stuff, repeating literally entire scenes from the first Hellboy film. Yeah.
If there's anything Spider-Man has taught us, is that everybody loves a good origin story.
Oh my God. I hope that we end up like just not having any more origin stories for a while.
You know, speaking of origin stories and superheroes, we haven't talked about the Coppola and do we want to get it?
Okay. No, I tweeted about it. You know, old man yells at cloud.
There was a really good Vulture article about it. Is what I was going to.
Oh yeah, tell me what did Vulture? What was Vulture's take on this? Just to be clear for podcast listeners, Francis Ford Coppola said last week that he found the Marvel films not just bad, he found them despicable.
This was followed on Scorsese weighing in.
Didn't think they were
saying they were theme park rides.
Yeah, they were theme park rides, and that cinema is supposed to transform you, and they didn't transform him, which is a totally reasonable take.
It's a fair
reaction. Completely. Yeah. There's nothing unfair about that reaction. It's just, you can't shit on other people's fandom. That's verboten to me.
It's the 14-year-old.
Tell me you don't like it, but don't tell me that it's not worth liking.
Yeah.
That's all I want to say about that. Like, don't be an idiot.
There's room for both.
There is.
The Irishman can succeed very well.
These guys were young filmmakers. Their films were too violent, and the old guard didn't like their films, and they were this and that.
They've become the thing that...
Right.
And their friends are responsible for the creation of this thing. Spielberg and Lucas are responsible for this entire... Like, this starts with Jaws and Star Wars. It's like you don't have Tony Stark.
And the reason we love Scorsese and Coppola is because of their incredible brains and their incredible creativity and their specific opinions about how things should be.
Yeah.
Obviously, we are better as a culture for them expressing that. But again, don't shit on my fandom.
Don't pull up the
don't
ladder.
Tell me what I'm gonna or not gonna get from this, because one of the things that I'd also watched on the plane was Endgame for like the seventh time. And it's just as much fun the seventh time.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So, on a completely unrelated note, there's a new Xi Shen Liu book that came out in the United States. Called Supernova Age.
I'm so excited to buy that tomorrow.
Supernova Era, sorry.
Okay. Is there an audiobook?
I don't know. I haven't looked yet. The premise is really good. I just read the blurb because there have been a few books that have come out, and some of them I picked up and some of them not so much.
Have you read Ball Lightning?
I have not read Ball Lightning yet.
It's so good.
Okay, I should read Ball Lightning. The idea is that there's a supernova relatively close to us, and everyone over the age of 13 is going to die. Like that's the age at which people, it's unclear why they survive under 13 and don't over 13. Don't know why. I just read the blurb.
Oh, the stem blurb was cells or something. Yeah,
whatever.
Something.
Maybe radiation exposure. Maybe they choose to put maybe they're like, we have room for 2 million people in the bunkers that will survive the radiation
all the
babies. From
this. Fascinating.
So we put them all in the bunkers.
Oh.
And it's about dumping as much of humanity's knowledge into these 13-year-olds as you can. Before in the time that you have before the first wave hits.
While I was on my, I can't wait to read that. I'm literally going to go to Dog-Eared and buy it tomorrow. While I was on vacation, I read the new Haruki Murakami book, Killing Commendatore.
Holy cow. Is it good?
It's so good. I finished it and just started reading it again.
Is it like 1Q84 dense and scale?
Yes.
It's a lot of
books. It is simpler in its allegory.
Okay.
So 1Q84 I have read twice and I still don't understand it, right? Like it still has all this depth to it that like escapes me. Its structure. I felt like I read two different books.
1Q84 feels like two books when you're reading.
Well,
I would say.
And you read it a second time, it'll be four books.
Okay.
Because it's like, it's so deep.
There's the bit with the well, there's the bit with going for the father. There's a lot happening there.
Killing Commendatore is, it's about a painter and it's about finding the truth of a creative enterprise. And it's about coming to terms with the secrets that you've held on to and the things that you wished were different.
Oh.
There's a point at which, and this is not a spoiler for the book, even though it's a little bit of a spoiler, it won't change your reading of the book at all. There's a point at which a character is confronted by someone who shows up out of thin air. And they're like a perfect simulacrum of a human being. They're just one third the size. They're 2 feet tall. And they say, "What are you?" And the person says, "Well, I've taken this form, but I'm just an idea." And like, you're off to the races.
Murakami books feel like they were written by someone who you described the platonic ideal of a book to, of a story. And then they were just like, okay, I got this without ever having actually heard another story.
They all feel as unique as that. So as I've read Killing Commendatore now 1.5 times, we ended up shipping it back because we shipped a bunch of clothes back halfway through. So we didn't have to traipse around with stuff.
Pro tip.
And then I came home and picked up Wild Sheep Chase, which was my first Murakami book. I think it was his first big hit. And it's very much a Chandler book through and through. It's like he's deeply channeling Raymond Chandler and Marlowe. And so I'm right in the middle of my Haruki Murakami love affair again.
It's funny because it's funny watching the evolution of an author and seeing which way they choose to go. Because like Michael Chabon started out writing books that he clearly loved, about topics that he clearly loved, and then just went further and further into things like things that he loved, mashing them together in interesting, fun ways.
Yeah.
And Murakami, I think, is just getting weirder and weirder the further along he gets.
Well, so I don't know if you caught this, but there's a whole bit to 1Q84 that is about the page numbering.
Yeah. And when he's talking about the other the other book and the moon stuff, right?
There, but and there's subsets of page numbering that that I don't even know why they're different.
Wait, the page numbering in the physical book is different?
Uh-huh.
Which, well, I read it on a Kindle, so I probably didn't get that.
Which pages have numbers actually matters in the plot.
Like, how the hell do you translate that?
It's hard to explain. It's just that...
Do you put the secret decoder page over the pages so that the words, you pick only the words?
It's kind of like you start to realize that even though the book proceeds linearly, that actually there's a whole separate thing happening on the left page than the right page as you're reading the book.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
I would never have, like, having read that on an e-reader.
You know, I would strongly recommend. So the other thing about Murakami, and this is real for me when I'm confronted by writers who don't write in English, is, am I reading the translation that I should be reading?
I mean, right? the Si Shen Lu situation, Dark Forest, the translation for that is not anywhere near as lyrical as the one is for the first, I can't remember the name of the first book in that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so for, like, I've quoted Letters to a Young Poet by Rilke, and there's three different translations that I know of, and one of them is three times as good as the other two, in my opinion, in the way that it's written. Murakami actually speaks English, so he goes over his translations after they've been done, and I think, I don't know whether what the full process is, but I know that the translation gets his okay.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It's very plausible that, just off the top of my head, that Chabon and Murakami are my two favorite writers of all time.
Chabon is definitely one of my favorites.
I actually just bought, because I kept giving it away, I just bought another copy of Yiddish Policeman's Union because I want to read it again. I want to go back to Sitka. I want to talk about the Verbover Mafia.
Have you read China Mieville? Mabel?
I can't remember. I have 3 Seconds of an Explosion.
Oh, I haven't read that one.
And
The City in the City.
It was given to me recently, a couple of years ago, when I have not read that. 3 Moments from an Explosion, something like that.
Yeah. The City in the City is very much your business. It's like it's very Yiddish Policeman's Union in ways that I don't want to get into.
Cool.
But it's science fiction. It's far enough future science fiction that it's fantasy, if you know what I mean. And it's about two cities that are completely distinct from each other, completely separated from each other, but are geographically exactly overlapping with each other. Ooh. So people in one city don't interact with people in the other city, even though they're sharing the same space.
Wow.
And it's a Chandler-esque kind of detective story that happens in that space.
I love it.
Very good.
Love it.
Yeah.
Wow. We've covered a lot of
wide ranging one. Yeah.
A lot of recommendations. Oh, TV recommendations. There's a new season of Abstract on Netflix.
Abstract is a fantastic show. My friend Scott Dadich, former editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, of Jeffrey Dadich, is one of the executive producers. It is a beautiful deep dive into the creative process. That is my doorbell. It is a beautiful deep dive into the creative process of each of the creators, and each episode is different depending on who it's covering. Ooh. So it is very cinematic, and
the directors of each episode put their own style on it.
It's totally amazing. And so I have to answer that. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Pause that for 1 second.
Okay. Sorry about that.
All right.
That's okay.
We're just wrapping it up. Anyway. You lose the phone call just as you're saying goodbye and you have to call back just to say goodbye? That's what just happened.
Hey, thanks.
Highly recommended. There's an episode on Ruth Carter, who was the costume designer not only on most recently Black Panther, but also so many of Spike Lee's movies.
All of Spike Lee's movies.
Of his movies. And a look at her work, how she became costume designer. That's probably my favorite episode so far. Dave Chang, friend of Tested, has a new Netflix show as well, Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner. It's just like, it's not Ugly Delicious. It's a little bit more like The Chef Show, where him and celebrity friends kind of go around, eat a lot of food, talk about cooking.
Nothing I like more than watching famous people
eat. Seth Rogen, Kate McKinnon, some Awesome stuff there. Movie recommendations. A lot of great stuff coming out for the end of the year. I know you're seeing Jojo Rabbit.
I'm seeing Jojo Rabbit this really weekend. Want to see and that. Tess is just about to make a trip to another show that that we like, and we're going to go on set again.
Ooh, yeah. There are early screenings of Knives Out happening
around
the country.
That's the other one. That's Knives Out's the Rian Johnson movie. Yeah. I really want to see that.
I'm going to try. Ryan, we're going to try and get you on the podcast while you're here. He's coming up for Wire 25.
That's right. I saw that.
Adam Rodgers is interviewing
him. Adam Rodgers is going to interview him.
Why not Chris Evans on the podcast?
I'm going to try.
We have his shield here.
I want to show Chris my Cap costume.
Yeah, his shield is right here. It's right
there.
I can see it.
Cap, come on over, buddy.
It's America's ass.
And I want to give the highest recommendations to the movie Parasite. It's the Korean film.
I'm so excited about going to see that.
Yes.
Oh, also, Karina Longworth, you must remember this.
Yes.
Has back now. It's been on hiatus since January, and it's, I think, like a 7-part series on Disney's Song of the South.
Wow.
And the protests that happened when it was released in the 40s.
Really?
Oh, yeah, no, she's going deep. The first episode's out, and it's fantastic. I'm so happy that podcast is back.
We had the most wonderful conversation about movies at South by Southwest when I had 15 years ago, when I had we were sitting at a bar on 6th Street, just casually, and it was like, oh, what do you do? Oh, I do a podcast about movies. What do you do? Oh, I make computer stuff. And we just chatted about movies for 20 minutes while we drank a beer.
She's amazing. I've listened to dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of You Must Remember This. It is one of the best podcasts. It is such dense scholarship.
It's so much information.
Oh my God. So worth listening to.
Norm, Parasite?
Parasite. That's all I can say is don't watch the trailer. Just watch it. It's playing in San Francisco at the
Alamo
Draft
House. It's not like a creepy horror movie. It's a psychological
thriller.
Thing.
It's a psychological thriller. It's not supernatural horror if you don't like jump scares.
Okay.
It's not the thing. It's not about body horror. It's
good.
It is social commentary and it's
good.
It's rapturing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Sounds like a good place to wrap it up. What's on the site this week, Norm? Anything good?
By the time you watch this week, we have One Day Build. You had a friend, Anthony Kovacs, come to town. You did a collaboration with him, both lots of space stuff. So, yeah, that's the next thing on the site.
Talked about monitors, screen refresh rates.
Your podcast is?
Tech Pod. Brad and Will made a Tech Pod. It's at techpod.content.town.
There you go, techpod.content.town.
Yeah.
I love it.
See you guys next week.
All right, guys.
See you.
Bye.